Is something cataclysmic coming to America? Does a biblical pattern laid out in the law speak to this very question? My guest, Jonathan Collin, is going to weigh in.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It's very obvious, it's very clear that America is shaking. It's very obvious, very clear that the world is shaking. There have been times of great upheaval through world history. There have been times of great shaking in American history. Is there anything unique going on today? Or put another way, is there anything unique in that Scripture foretells it? Scripture points to it. Michael Brown, welcome to The Line of Fire. I'm about to be joined by my special guest, Jonathan Collin. Jonathan is a friend, Messianic Jewish leader, and a New York Times best-selling author. His first book, The Harbinger, had results that, to me, were supernatural. New York Times bestseller from the first week it came out, and doors opened to address Congress and others as a result of it. And basically, the whole message is a wake-up call. The whole message of the book is that God judged Israel in the past. Judgment is coming to America now. Wake up. And whether you agreed with every point of the book or not, to me, you had to step back and say, is God trying to get our attention? Well, what happened after that is focusing on one particular aspect from his Harbinger book, Jonathan wrote a follow-up book, The Mystery of the Shemitah, talking about the seventh year of release in the Bible, that every 7 years debts would be canceled and things like that. And then on the the 50th year, the Jubilee year, laid out in depth in Leviticus 25, indentured land would return to its original owners. Lifetime slaves would be freed, and of course, debts would be released. And we know that when God judged the land of Judah, and the people of Judah went into captivity for 70 years, that the reason it was 70 years was because the land did not rest in the seventh year, because that was also a Sabbath for the land. And because the land was not given rest, God said, okay, we are giving the land special rest. Well, is there something then of a pattern? Is there a pattern that ties in with finances? This is something that Jonathan has argued in his new book, The Mystery of the Shemitah. And there is now a brand new DVD. I was watching it last night. You talk about compelling. You talk about riveting. You talk about something that gets your attention. Wow. I mean, this book absolutely does. And the DVD, all the more. We've just got 1 minute before the break here. Jonathan, it's great to have you back on The Line of Fire with us.
Great to be with you, Mike. Always great.
Before we get into some of these riveting issues, and again, watching the DVD late last night, what a powerful presentation. We've just got 30 seconds now, but you're about to address the United Nations this Friday?
Well, I'm going to be at the United Nations. I'm going to be speaking, this Friday in the afternoon about on behalf of believers who are persecuted around the world. So I've been invited to speak there, yes.
And then Capitol Hill, April 29th?
That's an opening that is actually opened by The Harbinger, the book. And, it's going to be the day after the Supreme Court hears the case on marriage. So I think it's going to be very, very critical.
Wow. Amazing timing. We're going to talk about timing when we come right back with Jonathan Collin. What is the mystery of the Shemitah? Okay, and what's happened since the book came out? What's happened now in America? Any signs that he's on to something here? We'll be right back. Change the world.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Could there exist a mystery going back to ancient times that's been affecting, even molding our lives from the days we were born? From events of global proportions to the state of our bank accounts, our past, our present, and our future. And what does it foretell concerning what is yet to come? What is this mystery? It's called the mystery of the Shemitah.
This is Michael Brown, and I am joined today by my friend, guest, author of Mystery of the Shemitah, Jonathan Kahn. Jonathan, before we dive into some of the specific issues, that was a clip from the DVD that has just been released that's very powerfully put together. When folks get the DVD, what's on there that is additional material?
Well, the first thing is that they're going to see the things, you know, happen. The Mystery of the Shemitah is, spans really all of from ancient history to today to modern times. So they're actually going to see really everything. So there's some things that come out visually that way that are kind of stunning than, you know, when you just read it. The other thing is that there's about an hour of bonus material where answering questions about end time prophecy, about preparing, about, you know, all the most often asked questions. So it's about 2 hours with, and it's a very, you know, I'm in it, of course, but I didn't do it. They did a real stunning thing. It's just very, very powerful.
Yeah, it is. I mean, obviously your part is excellent and clear, and just I'm used to reading things, but watching the DVD was really very, very intense. So how, in your mind, does the mystery of the Shemitah become linked to judgment? It's clear that it's a time of release.
Yes.
We understand that. We understand that the judgment that came on Israel when it didn't let its land rest on the Sabbaths. But many would say you're making a jump here. You're going too far. So how do you connect this to judgment?
Yeah, well, first of all, the word Shemitah, which, again, means release in Hebrew, also means literally fall, to collapse, to be shaken. The other thing is that really when the judgment came in 586 BC on Judah, the southern kingdom, it's very clear from the time of the Torah, from the law of Moses to the prophets, that the Shemitah was the sign of the judgment. It was the timing, the 70 years that they were in captivity. It says the land will rest for the 70 year, or for the years it did not rest, it did not keep its Sabbath. So those are the Shemitahs. So now everything that Israel did, I mean, they offered up their children as sacrifices. They descended to gross immorality. Yet the Shemitah becomes the timing, becomes the, you know, when the Bible speaks of this, and when Jeremiah is given the time, and it's written in Chronicles as well, that God is saying the Shemitah is the sign of the timing of that judgment. So it clearly is. And even with that, I mean, for that to happen, for Israel to be destroyed at that time, it had to be, according to this, the Shemitah, it also meant the rise of the kingdom of Babylon. It had to come at the exact time for this to happen. And then it had to fall at the exact time, and then the Persian Empire had to rise as well to complete those 70 years of the Shemitah. So the Shemitah, I mean, this is just by that, you know, world history is tied into this whole thing.
Yeah, all right. Now, when your book came out, which is recently, this is not years ago, your book came out, you're obviously looking at things happening in America, looking at things happening in the world, and a lot of this is talking about what could be coming. Since your book has come out, is there anything else happening that ties in with it, or that should get our attention, or potential events that make us think, all right, God's trying to say something to us?
Yeah, well, one of the things is that the pattern of the Shemitah, and you know, Michael, I mean, I hope I said it the last time, and I try to always say this, I'm not setting dates, and not saying that God has to do anything, and that it always has to be at every cycle. However, I believe we need to be prepared and ready. One of the things is that, you know, the word Shemitah, as I said, can mean the fall. One of the sections on the DVD is linked to the fall, the rise and fall of nations, that's linked to it as well. Well, one of the things that happened, the Shemitah began, and the pattern is generally this. At the beginning, if something is going to happen, it's not dramatic at the beginning, but at the end, when it reaches that climax time, which is in the autumn, that's when these things tend to happen. That's the last two cycles. That's when you had the crashes on the exact time. Well, at the beginning of this Shemitah, you know, within the first week of the Shemitah, very interesting, a very significant thing happened. America, number one, I've been warning this for really a long time since the Harbinger, that if we don't turn back, that our crown as the head of nations, the American age, is going to come to an end. Well, that first week, America, which was the number one nuclear power on Earth, it was dethroned by Russia. Russia has surpassed us now as the number one nuclear power, that's military. Within the second week of the Shemitah, something even more dramatic happened. Since the year 1871, America has been the strongest economic power on Earth. That's actually in the book, in the section called The Mystery of the Towers. So from that moment on, we were the strongest economic power. Then we became the strongest military power and many other things. But the American age begins then. Well, that age, 140 years, that age came to an end as the second week of the Shemitah came in, that we have been dethroned, the crown has passed to China. I mean, that is major, that is gigantic. I mean, I believe there's much more, but, I mean, there's much that we can talk about, but the thing is that alone is a historic, gigantic change. It's the ending or the beginning of the ending of the American age, and that's going to continue. And so that's just a little bit. Now, one of the things is also is that we are witnessing, I believe, a very critical year right now in the year of the Shemitah, and that is that we have in the first few weeks. I'm sure you remember this, Michael, because you're on this. And that is that the first few weeks, the Supreme Court made a decision not to hear an appeal concerning gay marriage. And what that decision, non-decision, did is from that time, the beginning of the Shemitah year in autumn, there was the number of states that had redefined marriage, ended the biblical definition of marriage, was in the teens. It is now, you know, approaching 40 states. It was a sweeping, it was a massive transformation. And now we are heading to the Supreme Court decision, which I believe is going to be a crucial, a watershed, just like Roe versus Wade, which, by the way, was also in the year of the Shemitah. There are critical points, and I believe we are inviting judgment. So this is if the Supreme Court rules for the ending of marriage as defined in the Bible, which it looks like it will, I believe we are inviting judgment.
There's a section on the DVD called The Mystery of the Cataclysms, and it reveals how this phenomenon is still in effect, still affecting our lives to this day. So economy, bank accounts, stock market. Can you explain that?
Yeah. If you look at one of the things of the Shemitah is that the first thing it affected was the economic realm and financial realm. On the last day of the Shemitah, called Elul 29, the very last day, which is in autumn, all the debts of the nation were wiped out. All the credit was wiped out. It's a financial nullification. Well, if you look at the last 50 years, or I'd say 40 years, actually even beyond that, every long-term collapse of the financial market, every long-term collapse has happened at a seven-year cycle. And on the actual time of the Shemitah, every single one, 1973, 1980, 87, 2000, 2007, everything's been on the year of the Shemitah. If you look at the greatest point crashes in modern history, the majority of them happen at the end of the Shemitah year, at that time of nullification. In the last two cycles of the Shemitah, which is 2000 and 2001, 2008, you have the greatest point crashes in world history. They not only take place in the Shemitah year, not only at the end of this cycle when you have that wipeout, but each one happens on the Elul 29, the exact day appointed in the Bible. That's the wipeout day. That is the wiping out of financial accounts. In 2001, it happens caused by 9/11. September 17th is Elul 29. And then the greatest point crash is in 2008, September 29th, is on Elul 29 again, the greatest point crash in world history. Each one happens on the same exact Hebrew day, and the day that happens to be appointed to wipe out the financial accounts, and that are, according to the mystery of the Shemitah, the collapses are 7 years apart. Well, the greatest two crashes up to those days are separated by seven biblical Hebrew years, down to the day, down to the hour, the minute, the second. Nothing but the hand of God could do that. I mean, that alone is truly mind-boggling. And those are the last two cycles. So the phenomenon appears to be intensifying.
Yeah, and obviously you can be reading Scripture and getting a certain insight, And then you look at something happening in history, and it unfolds in such an uncanny way that then causes you to go back and say, is there more to this? Jonathan, we've got 30 seconds. Has anyone raised a major criticism that in any way has knocked this theory down? Or to the contrary, are you getting more confirmation by the day?
No, I actually have been contacted by people on Wall Street who have said, yes, you know, there has been, we knew there was always this 7-year cycle, and that not only that, but it was on these exact time, these years, but they had no idea that it was the Shemitah, had no idea. Now, I'm not saying something has to happen every time. However, a lot of things are converging right now, and I believe we need to be ready. I do believe that, yeah, a great shaking is coming.
Yeah, friends, at the very least, wake up, America. God's speaking to us in 1,000 different ways. Wake up, Church of America. Wake up.
Give us strength to always do what's right. It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
You know, one thing that I didn't realize with my friend Jonathan Kahn, we've never talked about this, but Jonathan, we'll have to get into this another time, but you became an atheist at 8 years old. Same with my wife, Nancy.
Okay.
And she came to faith at 19. You came to the Lord at 20.
I came on my 20th birthday, so it's pretty close.
Yeah, it actually is. But you were starting to seek the truth around 12 years old. Yeah, Nancy was quite hardened by the time we met. Amazing.
Well,
not a lot of kids make that conscious choice to remember the time, but we'll have to take that up another time. Obviously, you're if you're an atheist today, all of this would challenge it a lot.
Yeah. I think sometimes like that, we minister in the way we were ministered to. You know, I was an atheist, and I needed reasons to believe, and I picked up a book when I was about 13. I thought it was a UFO book, you know, and it turned out it was The Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey. And it was kind of like the Lord kind of tricked me, because all about end time prophecy. And as an atheist, I couldn't argue with the fact that the Bible had said Israel would come back into existence and all these things, nor could I argue with the fact that when I was reading the Hebrew scriptures after that the Messiah was born in Bethlehem, our Jewish Messiah, he was going to die for our sins, all these things that I thought were Catholic. So I needed those reasons, and I both the Harbinger and the mystery of the Shemitah are such that you can be an atheist. It doesn't matter who where you come from. These are things that are happening right now in our day. So it's very hard to argue with.
All right, near the end of the mystery of the Shemitah DVD, and friends, I'll tell you in a moment how you can get a copy of this. 2 hours. It is compelling. It is powerful. Jonathan is narrating tremendous graphics. It's really the kind of thing you'll just watch and be stirred by. We'll tell you in a moment how you can get that. But near the end of the DVD, you speak about the mystery of the Shemitah in terms of end-time prophecy,
yes,
specifically the mystery of the seventh Shemitah. So please expand on that.
Yeah. One of the things that the people don't realize, that with end-time prophecy, there's a real link to the Shemitah because, for instance, you know, the last period of end-time prophecy is the tribulation period. Well, that's a 7-year cycle based on Daniel's 77s, which are in turn based on the 77s of judgment or the 70 years of judgment, which has to do with the Shemitah. So the Shemitah is a real key on this in God's timing. Well, it's not just that every 7 years was the Shemitah, this Sabbath year, but every seventh Shemitah was a super Shemitah, or it ushered in a super Shemitah that we call the Jubilee, and that's on the 50th year. The 49th year ushers in the 50th. Well, the thing is that at the Jubilee, what happened is, you know, everyone, whatever you lost your family's possession, you lost your ancestral home, whatever you lost those things on the Jubilee on this super Shemitah, you would return home, you'd regain it, everybody shall return home to their father's possession. Well, here's the thing. When you look at end-time prophecy, one of the keys is that Israel, the Jewish people, have to return home. The Messiah can't come until it happens. So they have to return to Israel. They have to return to Jerusalem. Well, could this mystery of the seventh Shemitah, could this give us a key to the timing of these end-time events? And the answer is, amazingly, yes. Now, one thing is we don't know when the Jubilee was, or what, because we don't have any records from the Second Temple time when they celebrated. But we do know when the Shemitah was celebrated from ancient records. So therefore, here's the key. The Jubilee has to follow the year of a Shemitah. It would be the seventh Shemitah, but it has to follow the year of the Shemitah. Well, 1917 is the year of the Shemitah, and it ends in September 1917. So this next, the year following, this what could be this prophetic period, is September 1917 to September 1918. Did anything significant happen at that time linked to restoration or prophecy? The answer is totally yes. What happens at that time is the Turkish Ottoman Empire crashes, that had taken the land of Israel for 400 years. The British Empire takes Israel, issues the Balfour Declaration in November 1917, which is right in the time parameter, and they issue it. What it is doing, it's restoring Israel as a homeland to the Jewish people. Everyone shall return to their homeland, or to their lost possession. Now, that's 1917. What happens if you go to the next seventh Shemitah in this mystery? Where does it take us? It takes you to the Shemitah that ends September 1966. So the period now of following is September 1966 to September 1967. Did anything significant happen in that period, prophetically linked to restoration? That is the time in that June 7th, 1967, is the Six-Day War, when the Israeli soldiers enter the gates of Jerusalem. They get to the Western Wall. It is the restoration of Jerusalem in that exact time parameter following the seventh Shemitah. And, you know, everyone shall return to their possession. The Jewish people return home. And what happens when the Jubilee comes? What do? You sound the shofar. The first thing they do when they get to that wall is they sound the shofar. And the man who sounds it is Rabbi Shlomo Goren, very, very famous rabbi. Rabbi Shlomo Goren was born in the year 1917, the other Jubilee, and it's his 50th year of existence, and he's the one sounding at the time of the seventh Shemitah. Now, I'm not saying that God has to continue that pattern. However, if he did, where would it take us? When is the next seventh Shemitah? The answer is the next seventh Shemitah is 2015, right now, which would mean that the period linked to this Jubilee or restoration would be September 2015 to September 2016. Now, I'm not saying it has to be, but I'd be aware of it. But every time in the last cycles, what it has meant is war has taken place. It has been war in the Middle East. It centered on the land of Israel, and it resulted in a prophetic restoration. Again, not being dogmatic, but I would be aware of the signs of the times.
You know, Jonathan, as you're speaking, and I'm thinking about the DVD and the book, and all the material that you have, it reminded me of when I went one time to a really nice steak restaurant with my wife for anniversary. Okay. And they come out first and they give a presentation and they show you the foods. They show you what's there, and then you go to order and then you get to enjoy the meal. Friends, what Jonathan's done today is basically showed you some of the menu and what's actually there. This DVD, powerful, riveting, great to give to a Jewish seeker as well, or a skeptic, and so upbuilding for Bible believers. The DVD, 2 hours, so it's got an extra hour of additional material, plus our interview today, just $20 postage paid for the DVD and the CD. And, you know, Jonathan, we travel overseas a lot. And when you get overseas, your body has to adjust to the fact that there's another clock that's running. You know, I'm in Singapore, it's 13-hour time difference, whatever. But that clock has been going steadily. Our bodies just have to adjust to it when we get there because we're in a different time zone. A lot of us have no conception about the biblical calendar, no connection to the biblical calendar. But that's been ticking. God's calendar has been ticking all along. Friends, number to call, 1-800-278-9978. That's 1-800-278-9978 for the Mystery of the Shemitah DVD plus the CD of the interview I just did with Jonathan Cahn. Or you can go to my website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. And when you go there, you'll see a link. You can also click to watch some of the excerpts from the DVD, and then you can order from there. Jonathan, whenever you're able to join us on the Line of Fire, come back and let's continue to talk and let's continue to stir the church to wake up.
Thank you, Michael, so much. Sorry for keeping you up last night, and keep up the great work, my friend.
Oh, yeah, the DVD kept me up. I was blessed to be up. God bless you, man.
God bless. Bye.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yes, a revolution is what we need, a moral and cultural revolution, a gospel-based revolution, not a revolution of violence or hatred or intimidation or anger, but a revolution of God's people living as God's people, a revolution of God's people holding to biblical values, a revolution that's based on the gospel and then impacts society, because as we change, society will be impacted. And as people who do not know the Lord come to the Lord, society will be impacted. And as the, just think of this, if God's people, followers of Jesus, are to be the light of the world, or the church, in the words of Martin Luther King Jr., is to be the moral conscience of society, the conscience of the society, as our light shines more brightly, it will dispel more darkness. As our light shines more brightly, it will affect the moral climate of the society. As our conscience becomes more sensitive, it will affect the conscience of the nation. 866-34-TRUTH. In a moment, I'll be speaking with Professor Paul Kengor. Just had a riveting interview with my friend Jonathan Kahn, Messianic Jewish best-selling author, his new book, The Mystery of the Shemitah. And I'll be talking with Paul Kengor, who's written a new book that's going to be out, I think just next month, called Takedown. We'll be talking about that in a little while and really trying to get some understanding about some of the things that have been happening in our society with regard to religious liberties and the law. So while I have a moment, let me just give you an introduction. Dr. Paul Kengor, New York Times bestselling author. Hey, Matt, I don't remember in 1 hour that we had two interviews. We really don't have two interviews in an hour. And both of the authors were New York Times bestselling authors. But he's a best-selling author, New York Times best-selling author, professor of political science at Grove City College, which is a four-year private Christian liberal arts college in Grove City, Pennsylvania. He's executive director of the Center for Vision and Values, which is a Grove City College think tank and policy center. Also a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institute on War, Revolution, and Peace at Stanford University. And his articles have appeared in numerous publications, including New York Times, New York Post, National Review, San Francisco Chronicle, Washington Times, USA Today, and on. Oh, and how about National Catholic Register, Jewish Press, Jewish, whoa, that's quite a list here. Other books he's written, just to give you a little background before Professor Kengor joins us on the air. One of his books is 11 Principles of a Reagan Conservative, another, The Crusader, Ronald Reagan and the Fall of Communism, and another, The Communist, Frank Marshall Davis, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mentor. Looks like Professor Kengor is not afraid to tackle controversies. And in his new book that's going to be out just in a matter of weeks, called Takedown, Paul Kengor points to origins going back to Karl Marx, all right, tracing things back to Karl Marx, going through Margaret Sanger and others, different radicals of the 60s as he goes through the decades, and shows how these ideologies that were once considered radical and fringe have become in many ways mainstream, even to the point of affecting Congress and judges. So we come back. This is going to be an eye-opening interview with Professor Paul Kengor, his new book, Takedown. Also, we'll get some insights about what happened in Indiana, Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and has the media portrayed this accurately? We'll be right back.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It is great to be with you today on The Line of Fire, and I'm thrilled to welcome to the broadcast for the first time Professor Paul Kengor to talk about his new book. It's going to be out just in a matter of weeks, Takedown, From Communists to Progressives, How the Left Has Sabotaged Family and Marriage. Paul, great to have you on the broadcast with us. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's good to be with you, Dr. Brown. Thanks.
Now, you have written in authoritative ways about Ronald Reagan, about the fall of communism. You're a quoted and published author, professor. I gave all the credentials the last segment. The book could sound almost extreme to people. Almost
right.
One of these, you know, conspiracy theories that you find on the internet with someone with no credibility. It's quite the opposite with you. So what goes into a presentation like this and a radical thesis, from communist to progressive, how the left has sabotaged family and marriage?
Yeah, well, in a way, we're dealing with people who were extremists, and we're dealing with, in communism, something that was a conspiracy of sorts, right? I mean, it was organized by the Comintern, the Communist International, out of the Soviet Union. But what I trace here, Michael, is there has been a very sustained effort going back into the 1800s of communists and socialists and progressives who've tried to redefine, to change family and marriage. And in particular, they've tried to take down natural, traditional, biblical family and marriage. Now, the idea of gay marriage or same-sex marriage, that never occurred to Marx and Engels.
Yep.
And you know, cultural Marxists like Herbert Marcuse, Wilhelm Reich. I mean, as crazy even as the Freudian Marxists were in the 1930s and 1940s, none of them could have conceived of the crazy possibility of two men marrying one another or two women marrying one another. So none of them were ever thinking of same-sex marriage. But if you follow this long evolution going back from the 1800s up through today, you could see how they hit away at it. They chipped away at it to the point when same-sex marriage has finally come now in the 21st century, a really amazing thing has happened. Communist Party USA and even vehemently, viciously, militantly anti-homosexual regimes like the Castro regime in Cuba are amazingly now gung-ho and totally on board for gay marriage.
Mm.
And the argument that I make in trying to understand, well, gee, why would someone like Fidel Castro, who used to throw gay people in insane asylums, why would they be holding gay pride parades now in broad daylight in Havana? And for me, the answer is that for communists, their desire to take down the family, to attack biblical values, to attack natural law, tradition, was simply too overwhelming. And so whatever it takes to take down the family, to take down religion, that's what they'll do. So you now have this remarkable thing where even communists today are now in support of same-sex marriage.
You know what's fascinating? Many years ago, I was at a pro-life event, and the people protesting were Satanists, atheists, homosexuals, and witches. And I thought, What an interesting coalition of people protesting a pro-life event. I mean, those were the ones who are identifying themselves. Then if you go over to England, it was conspicuous that Muslims were pretty silent as the government there was, to the surprise of many, seeking to push through redefining marriage. And you'd think, hey, these Muslims are conservative and so on, and they're very militant against homosexuality, and yet they were fairly silent. The theory was, well, great, because they want to push for polygamy. They don't like this, but polygamy is more important to them. So it's almost a similar kind of thing where you've got these unusual coalitions because there are larger goals. Now, I was presented with some books a few years ago that were as to me, as extreme right-wing Christian as I could imagine, you know, King James only type, everybody else is going to hell type mentality. But they were analyzing the words of the Beatles, and they were criticizing Martin Luther King, and everything for them was a communist conspiracy. The funny thing is that almost everything they predicted actually happened.
What the common bond in so many of these, the common enemy is tradition, biblical worldview, Christianity. That's where they sort of coalesce and they ultimately come together. And it really is true. I mean, what you just said about polygamy and Muslims. When you redefine marriage as anything but one man and one woman, that is going to open the floodgates. There's no question about that, and I've told people all along, my beef is less with gay marriage, although I obviously have problems with that too, and I don't support it, than the fundamental transformation and redefining of marriage that gay marriage is going to allow for, and liberals, if you're listening, you know this is true. Once you redefine it as anything but one man and one woman, and your only standard is that consenting adults who love each other ought to get married, you are not going to be able to stop multi-party marriages. You're not going to be able to stop a Muslim man who wants three or four or five wives. And if and when that happens in America, 20 or 30 or 40 years from now, when a Muslim man can have four or five wives, liberals, you will have made that possible by redefining marriage as anything but one man and one woman. And in fact, you may have seen just a few weeks ago, there was, in fact, I think even Drudge reported it, there was the first three-man male-male-male marriage.
Sure, in Thailand.
That took place in Thailand, right. And you know, that will absolutely happen in other countries. The next thing for that male, you can't call it a couple, would be a triple. The next
Thruffle's actually the word. And we already had a lesbian thruffle in Massachusetts in 2013. So, yeah.
And the next thing will be the adoption of children. And that article, the one that Drudge linked to, I think it was one of the British publications, maybe the Daily Mail. And I went straight to the reader's comments. And I was hoping, Michael, that I would go there and see some mea culpas, right? OMG, the conservatives are right. This is going to make a mess out of marriage, right? No. I went there, and the comments were, God bless them. They look so beautiful together. We
love is
need
love.
More love in this world.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you know, when we finally get to the point where they all told us we were crazy for ever suggesting that we would get there, when we finally get to that point, they'll be on board for it, and then they'll call us hate mongers and fascists and bigots and homophobes and everything else for having opposed what at one time they said they opposed. This is the secular, progressive, left-wing mind and how it works and operates.
Yeah, it is a shocking thing when you talk to people. I mean, you're a political science professor. You're educating young people all the time. When you talk to people and rational thought no longer exists, there was a protest before a bill was being voted on in Charlotte. I was speaking at an event. Some people were protesting. So I went to talk to the protesters, and they were chanting against transphobia. Transphobia has to go. And one of them was upset with me and told me it is primitive. His word, primitive, to say that gender is defined by biology and chromosomes. That is primitive.
Right.
So I asked one of them, if I believe I'm a horse, can I use the stable? Yes, you're not hurting anyone. It's like the nation just drank the corporate Kool-Aid. Can you trace in your book Takedown how we got to this point of the whole nation coming under delusion, it seems?
Well, see, when you go against natural law, biblical law, absolutes, moral absolutes, then anything goes. You know, once words don't mean anything, or they mean whatever you want them to mean, then you have these kinds of dangers. You can redefine marriage and the abortion issue. You define when life begins. You do that all by yourself. There's a quote that I use in the book. It's from Masha Gessen, who is she's a Russian intellectual.
I know her. Yeah, I quoted her also.
Yeah. She, and it's very telling. She says it's a no-brainer that gays should have the right to marry, but I also think equally that it's a no-brainer that the institution of marriage should not exist.
Yep.
And she says, fighting for gay marriage generally involves lying about what we are going to do with marriage when we get there, because we lie that the institution of marriage is not going to change, and that is a lie. The institution of marriage is going to change, and it should change. And again, I don't think it should exist. And get this, she says, I have three kids who have five parents, more or less, and I don't see why they shouldn't have five parents legally. I met my new partner, and she just had a baby, and that baby's biological father's. She goes on and on, but this is going to make a mess out of marriage. When you redefine it as one man and one woman, this is what happens.
Yeah, once you redefine it, it becomes meaningless. Professor Kanger has a class at 3. He's got a few more minutes with us. I've got some questions for him. We come back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm speaking with Professor Paul Kanger. His forthcoming book out in a matter of weeks, Takedown, From Communists to Progressives, How the Left Has Sabotaged Family and Marriage. And Paul, right before the break, you quoted those amazing words from Moshe Gessen. I've actually played that clip. It was at a conference or a festival in Australia where she said it. I played that on the air, and I'm going to have that same quote in my book coming out later in the year, Outlasting the Gay Revolution. The fact is there are quite a few other quotes like that from gay activists and others who basically said, yeah, we want to redefine marriage because we don't think marriage as it stands should exist. And the earliest gay activists were absolutely militantly against marriage. It was the patriarchal owning of women and had to be smashed and destroyed. So now there's been a better strategy. The radical, we're here, we're queer, get used to it, didn't work. So instead, just to say, hey, we're like everybody else, same family, same marriage, just change the meaning of marriage, and it can be anything. And Paul, you're a political science professor. I've asked this question in public debates, on the air, social media, never once gotten an answer. You've alluded to it already. But if marriage is not the union of a man and a woman, why does it require two people? Why can't you marry yourself? Why can't it be three or eight? If it's not the union of a man and woman, have you ever heard a coherent answer to that?
No, I have not. And in fact, and what you're saying there, this idea, you use the word slavery, I think. Marx and Engels use that exact language.
Mm.
They referred to marriage as a form of prostitution, a form of slavery. Engels used the phrase a community of housewives held in common. Marx and the Communist Manifesto, exact words, abolition of the family, exclamation mark. Even the most radical flare-up of this infamous proposal of the communists, unquote. So they had been seeking to take down monogamous marriage, fidelity in marriage. They've been seeking to do this for 150, 160 years. But I think even they would be shocked at where culture and where society have gone. But when you chip away at that initial foundation, and especially in this modern culture where words can mean anything, you know, one thing that I say to gay rights supporters, if you would just call it something else, right? I mean, if you wouldn't call it marriage, then a lot of this acrimony that you're facing in a culture war, especially with Christians, you wouldn't be facing it. But by trying to call it marriage again, you know, for Christians, for Western civilization, for civilization in general, marriage has always meant the union of a man and a woman. You know, a tree is a tree, a dog is a dog, a cat is a cat, and marriage is marriage. But when people feel that they can redefine these things and call them whatever they want, that's when you get this kind of cultural chaos.
Yeah, and so you have in England now that in a marital contract, a husband can be a woman and a wife can be a man. And a bill they're pushing in California on a birth certificate, you can have a mother and father, both of whom are women, or mother and father, both of whom are men. So you can have male mothers and female fathers. So words no longer have meaning. It's like I say to you, okay, go up to the street and take a right, but right now means left. How can society exist based on that? Sir, we've got literally 1 minute before you have to run and teach a class.
Well, yeah, if I could add to that, and yet look how people are willing to rush in with no question whatsoever into this, right? Whether a right turn or a left turn or redefining family. I mean, we're just 20 years away from things like the National Fatherhood Initiative, where liberals finally agreed with conservatives that every child should have two parents. That fathers were crucial. And now suddenly, because of the gay rights revolution, liberals are jettisoning all of that. They're throwing it all out the window. And now you're suddenly, for the first time ever in all of human history, hearing these amazing claims from people on the left that it doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter if a child has a father at home. It doesn't matter if a child has two mothers. It doesn't matter if you have three parents. So all of these things were once common sense, and there was even a sociological consensus among liberals and conservatives on. The progressive left has now smashed and obliterated all of that under the name of gay rights.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling, eye-opening, and there must be a waking up first and foremost with the church in America that should have these values clearly. Paul, when you have a chance to join us again, let us know. I'd love to talk about religious freedoms with you. We didn't even get to this, but
I'm really
excited about the new book, Takedown, From Communist to Progressive, How the Left Has Sabotaged Family and Marriage. Paul, have a great class. Look forward to talking with you again.
Okay, Michael. Thanks a lot.
All right. Boy, I wish I had several hours to talk with Professor Kangor, but what you heard is an eye-opener. What you heard is an eye-opener. And when you go back and you realize how Margaret Sanger shared some of these very strong anti-family values, and you see this common thread, I'm thinking of the article that I wrote, came out on Monday. And by the way, I've got an important article coming out tonight. Could biblical preaching be outlawed? It's going to be an eye-opener. It's a real call to stand. That'll be coming out tonight. So if you connect with us on Facebook or Twitter, as soon as it's up, around 8 o'clock tonight, we'll post a link, and you can follow that and read that, or just go to my website later tonight, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org, and just click on latest article. You'll be able to read it there. But I wrote earlier this week about the common spiritual stream that flows through radical left thinking, through the new atheists, through radical gay activists. And basically what it comes down to is this: we will not have God as our king. We will not have biblical values as our guide. That's basically what is happening. It is a casting off of God's ways, and of course, the results will be absolutely catastrophic. The good news is there's plenty of time to wake up if we'll cry out to God earnestly. The good news is the future can be bright if we'll not play games and instead determine we're going to go after God. Can I encourage you to get hold of the special DVD, 2 hours, so that's an hour DVD plus an hour of bonus material, The Mystery of the Shemitah. It's powerful. It's compelling graphics. It's great narrative with Jonathan Cahn. And when you order it, we're paying the postage plus giving you the CD of the great interview that we did earlier today here on The Line of Fire. Just $20 together for both resources. And again, we're paying the postage. Order a few copies for yourself, for friends, for skeptics, for mockers, for seekers. $20 postage paid. Call 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978. Once more, that's 1-800-278-9978. Or go to the website, askdrbrown.org, to find out more. My bottom line today, without question, there are many ways God is shouting to us today to wake up. Will we hear? Or will we sleep on? Is there a systematic attempt by the left wing in America to take down marriage and the family?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I just had a terrific interview. Well, two terrific interviews. But the second one was with Professor Paul Kenger. He is a political science professor at Grove City College in Pennsylvania. And his new book is called Takedown. And it's quite an eye-opener. Now, remember, he's a professor, published professor in political science, a Reagan expert on communism, things like that. And the title of the book is Takedown from Communists to Progressives, How the Left Has Sabotaged Family and Marriage. And he shows this common theme, this common denominator theme of an attack on family, an attack on biblical morality, and how it comes through these different streams together, which to me does not mean that, say, a gay activist has necessarily read the Communist Manifesto. I'm assuming they haven't. I mean, they may have, like anybody else may have, but I don't think that they read that to fuel their ideology, right? They have their own ideology. I'm not saying necessarily that a left-wing progressive has fought for decades for the exact same goals the gay activists have, but I'm saying that spiritually there's something that connects them. Ideologically, there's something that connects them, and it ultimately comes right down to, boom, a confrontation over family, over motherhood, over fatherhood, over God's ways, over marriage as God intended it. Got a lot to talk about today on The Line of Fire. Thank you for joining us. 866-34-TRUTH. Again, this ties in with an article that we posted on Monday, what's really behind the attack on religious freedoms. If you haven't read that, go to AskDrBrown.org and click on latest article. Earlier in the broadcast, I did an interview with Jonathan Kahn, and it's always compelling to speak with Jonathan. And one of these things that's just kind of shaking in terms of, wow, that is intense. And we talked about the mystery of the Shemitah. I want to talk with you about that just a little bit more now, and I'll come back to that later in the broadcast. And I've got some data for you that's going to strengthen you in your faith and perspective that God's ways are ways of life, and it's going to shock you as well. But Joey, let's grab another clip here from the mystery of the Shemitah. Let's go over to clip number eight, talking about the Shemitah and the Balfour Declaration. Clip number eight.
It's the first time in 2,000 years that the land is being restored to the Jewish people. The year following the Shemitah was September 1917 to September 1918. The Balfour Declaration takes place in November 1917. Thus, the land is restored to the Jewish people in the year following the Shemitah, corresponding to the Jubilee. It's a prophetic Jubilee, and according to the mystery, the Jewish people now would return home to the land they had lost, to their father's possession, to their ancestral homeland. Everyone shall return to their possession.
That is the voice of Jonathan Kahn as he narrates on the Mystery of the Shemitah DVD. To find out more, go to my website, AskDrBrown.org. You'll see right on the homepage a link to this resource. Go there. You can watch some excerpts from the DVD. It's got 2 hours of material, so 1 hour of the DVD, then an hour of additional bonus material. When you get it, we're also sending you the CD interview that Jonathan and I just did. He said, I don't believe any of that stuff. Let me just say this. One way or another, God's seeking to get our attention. God is seeking to get our attention.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Before I share some really eye-opening data with you, some of this I shared at a lecture at UNC Greensboro last Thursday night, so 6 days ago. Some of you may have been there to hear it as you're listening now. Before I get into any of that, I want to bring you a word of encouragement. Michael Brown, thank you for joining us on The Line of Fire. The number to call, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. We will never win any spiritual battles. We will never be an effective force for the gospel. We will never live out our calling as overcomers and world changers unless on the most fundamental level in our relationship with God, in our walk with God, we have this sense of God being with us and for us. Now, if we're living in overt sin, if we don't know the Lord at all, God is not with us and for us in that regard. He is for us repenting. He is for us turning away from sin. He is for us getting right with Him. He is for forgiving us and bringing us into new relationship with Him. Absolutely. However, if we are in sin and unrepentant, He is against what we are doing and calling us to repent. But if we're His people and we love Him, we need to understand to the deepest, deepest possible meaning and significance, He is for us. He is with us. And therefore, we are overcomers. And therefore, victory is ours. And therefore, whether we are persecuted and put in jail or even beheaded, it is happening to our brothers and sisters in other parts of the world, or whether we become the president of the United States, whatever our circumstance, we are more than conquerors through Him who loved us. And there's this deep sense it's all going to be all right in the end. Have you ever been really confident about something? You're excited, you're expectant, maybe really believing that there's this big financial breakthrough that's going to take off this mountain of debt that occurred when a family member got in a bad accident and insurance only covered a certain amount and your family's been dragged down in debt and there's this big breakthrough and you find out that this money is coming your way you didn't even know about, and this sense of, oh, praise God, we're going to get out from under this mountain and all the creditors and the drain on our family and working the extra jobs. And then you get word, no, there was a legal technicality. You're actually not going to get that money. And your heart kind of sinks. Or maybe there's a loved one and there's a diagnosis of cancer. And you find out it's a very serious diagnosis and it could be terminal. And you're praying and you're crying out to God. And you have this sense of, I really believe there's going to be a breakthrough. I believe there's going to be a breakthrough. And then other friends call and say, you know, we really believe God's going to work a miracle and heal. And then you get word that the latest tests indicate that there's been a remission in the cancer and the doctors can't explain it. And you have this excitement. And yes, God's answering the prayer and the breakthrough is here. And praise God. And then 3 months later, it comes back with a vengeance and the person's gone. It's like everything crumbles. And where was God? And I must be deceived. You've all lived through something like this on some level. And it just struck me moments ago that, of course, I know this, I understand this, but I was struck afresh moments ago at how absolutely critically important it is for us to have this sense of God is with me, God is for me. It's almost like you're watching a football game and your team looks like they're going to lose this game. And it's the biggest game of the year for everybody involved. But somebody else is sitting there just smiling the whole time and they're rooting for the same team, but it looks like your team's coming down. And they're smiling the whole time. You say, why are you smiling? It's like, well, you know, actually, you're watching this on video delay from earlier today. But I watched it live, and we win in the end. It's got this dramatic, unbelievable victory. Then all the other stuff feels different. It's when you're uncertain of the outcome or uncertain of your relationship with God or uncertain of the surety of his promises or uncertain of your ability to receive those promises that you get really, really disheartened, and it's kind of like the bottom falls out. I can't guarantee you about everything that's going to happen in our society. In other words, I can't guarantee you that we'll recover the meaning of marriage in this generation. I can't guarantee you that we'll recover gender distinctives as God intended them in this generation. I can't tell you that abortion on demand will be overthrown legally in this generation and that there'll be a regathering and regaining of the sanctity of life. I can't guarantee that. I'm not guaranteed of those outcomes, but I'm guaranteed of the knowledge that the kingdom of God will ultimately triumph. I'm guaranteed of the knowledge that everything in the world, everything society, everything other people, everything the devil, everything that is meant for evil, God can turn around for greater good. And the thing that looked like the worst thing, you know, Joseph getting sold into slavery and then once in slavery, getting put in prison and it looks hopeless and all his dreams are going to be smashed. It ends up that from there, God turns things around and he becomes the right-hand man to Pharaoh and God uses it for the saving of many lives. You say, well, I'm really uncertain about God being with me and I don't walk in that confidence. What do I do? Don't beat yourself up. Don't blame yourself even more. Don't heap condemnation on top of your insecurities. Instead, meditate on who God is. Instead, meditate on the nature of his promises. We sang a song in worship on Sunday morning, and part of it is it's about the love of the Father for us and his love for us. That's who he is. That's who he is. And then for us, as his people, to be loved, that's who we are. That's who I am. So it starts with his goodness. It starts with his love. It starts with his promises. It starts with his faithfulness. It starts with the fact that his ways will triumph. It starts with the victory is ultimately vouchsafed because Jesus rose from the dead. So whatever is taking place all around us, however great the shaking, however great the upheaval, the bad news is the good news. God can use that to stir, to awaken, to change hearts, to change lives. Again, I find what's happening in our society terribly grievous. I find what's happening in much of the world terribly grievous. I also know, as we come starting tonight to Holocaust Remembrance Day, the 70th anniversary of the end of the Holocaust, I know out of one of the greatest tragedies and one of the most horrifically agonizing mysteries in the history of our nation, the history of the world, that out of that, the modern state of Israel was birthed. I'm not saying that God brought about the Holocaust in order to rebirth Israel. I'm not making that statement at all. What I'm saying is God is a redeemer. And out of death came life. Out of the ashes of the Holocaust came the modern state of Israel. And from a natural viewpoint, from an earthly viewpoint, there is no way that there would have been world sympathy for a state of Israel and the United Nations voting on this and approving it if not for what had happened in the years prior. And then even other goals that nations like Russia had in mind. God is faithful. The worst thing that ever happened to you through God's redemptive power can become the best thing that ever happened to you. A painful, agonizing divorce, the loss of a loved one, the loss of a child. You do anything possible to turn time back. You'd do anything possible to avoid the pain, the agony, the loss, and the things in and of themselves are agonizing and tragic and terrible and painful. Yet the God that we serve brings resurrection out of life and can make you into someone you never would have been before without the tragedy, without the pain, and can use you to touch others in ways that you never could have before without that tragedy, without the pain. We wish we could turn back the clock, obviously. We wish we could bring those lives back, obviously. And still, even though we can't bring them back in this world, God is a redeemer, God is a restorer. I want to encourage you to go before him and ask him to bathe you with the reality of his love and goodness so that you can walk and live with assurance and boldness and confidence, knowing that in him we live forever.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
What is the mystery of the Shemitah, and what does it have to do with your life? To find the origins, we must go back over 3,000 years to a Middle Eastern desert. It begins on Mount Sinai.
The nation of Israel has just come out of Egypt, and its leader Moses has ascended the mountain to receive the revelation of the Torah, or the law of God. In this revelation comes the law of the Shemitah.
You know, right now, Passover is just days behind us, and Holocaust Memorial Day, 70th anniversary of the Holocaust, right ahead of us, and the world in a continuous shaking with regard to Israel, Iran, the American economy, where is that going? The Mystery of the Shemitah is a really relevant resource. The calendar, God's calendar, keeps on ticking. How does it relate to us today? Listen, at the very least, even if you can't make all the biblical connections Jonathan's made, when you look at the stock market crashes and the seven-year cycles, just to ask yourself, what's God trying to tell me through that? What's he trying to tell America through that? What's the message through that? And is judgment in our midst? And is there something we can do about it? Through prayer, through crying out to God, 866-34-TRUTH. To order The Mystery of the Shemitah, it's a DVD, 2 hours, 1 hour, tremendous presentation, great animation, riveting, well done. 1 hour, plus an hour of bonus material, answering questions, objections, things like that, plus the CD of my interview with Jonathan Cahn. You can order by going to askdrbrown.org, and you can watch excerpts from the video there as well. Order as many copies as you like. Let's stay on that topic for one moment. Let's go to Abe in Tyler, Texas. Welcome to The Line of Fire.
Dr. Brown, thanks for taking my call. Listen, I got a couple questions, actually, but first I'd like to make a statement regarding a statement you made last hour. If you ever go to using a stall like a farm animal, I'll let you know it's going to hurt me, bud. But anyhow, when it comes to the Shemitah, what are the implications in regards to the Gentile, you know, like Acts 15?
I'm not sure I follow the question, Abe.
Well, I mean, I've come to understand that we're not really under that law, but I mean, the blessing and the curses, let's say, does that make more sense?
Right. Well, it's not a matter of being under the law, and it's not a matter of blessings and curses specifically covenantally over Israel, as much as to say that there is still meaning in the calendar. For example, I believe that even though the church is not called specifically or commanded to celebrate all the biblical feasts and holy days, that understanding their prophetic significance in Israel's past history, pointing to the cross and the resurrection and the outpouring of the Spirit, and future history, pointing to the Messiah's return, those things are important. I would look at larger principles of how does God deal with the nations as a whole when it comes to greed? How does God deal with the nations as a whole when it comes to immorality? How does God deal with the nations as a whole when it comes to covenant breaking? In other words, if you read Amos 1 and into the beginning of the second chapter, before God rebukes the house of Israel, which is done through most of the book, he rebukes the nations basically surrounding Israel. It kind of makes a giant X, you know, from the north to the northwest to the southeast, and then from the northeast to the southwest. It's like a giant X is painted over the nation of Israel. But as he's dealing with these pagan nations, remember, they did not have the law of Moses. They weren't required to live by the law of Moses. God didn't rebuke them because they didn't keep the seventh-day Sabbath. God didn't rebuke them because they didn't observe the dietary laws, but he rebuked them for cruelty. He rebuked them for covenant breaking. He rebuked them for violence and things like that. So there are universal moral laws by which God will judge the whole world. Genesis 9, after the flood, God made it clear that murder was forbidden. Whoever sheds man's blood by man shall his blood be shed, because in the image of God was man made. So because we're made in the image of God, murder, in that sense, is an assault on the image of God in man, an assault on God, and now downgrades the importance and value of a human life. So all that to say, Abe, I'd be looking at the larger principles of greed, of materialism, of rejection of God on a larger level, exploitation and cruelty and covenant breaking. And that's going to apply across the board. And could God be getting our attention with the 7-year cycles? That's the obvious question. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Cary, North Carolina. Eric, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi. I've been wondering about this for a long time. I learned about the Shemitah a few months ago from another program, and I've been trying to sort out about is it part of the old covenant, and how does the Shemitah apply under the new covenant?
Yeah, Eric, here's how I'd look at it, and I appreciate the question. This was a law that God gave Israel, right? So he never said that in a church setting that you do the same thing every 7 years that debts are released, or every 50 years that people with indentured property is returned and things like that. Rather, there's now the spirit of the Jubilee, and the spirit of the Shemitah. Jesus comes into the world, and when he preaches his first sermon in Luke, the 4th chapter, he says, "The Spirit of the Lord's on me, because he's anointed me to proclaim liberty to the captives, to preach good news to the poor, proclaim liberty to the captives." Those words, "proclaim liberty to the captives," that goes back to Isaiah 61, but Isaiah 61 has language that goes back to Leviticus 25, and that language speaks of the year of release, the year of Jubilee. So that has now been brought into play on a prophetic level, that we are called to set the captives free, and we are called to bring a message of forgiveness, and we are called to bring a message of liberation. That's how it applies on the larger level to us. And not to think in terms of, well, you know, if I do a loan, do I get it back? No, if you're able to give, you give. And if people can pay you back, great. If they can't, they can't. That's kind of the over and above that Jesus calls us to. However, it's not to say that God's calendar is not still in effect. See what I'm saying, Eric? In other words, is God still looking at these 7-year cycles? Is God still trying to get our attention? Has the clock ever stopped ticking on his end? And that's what Jonathan Kahn would be arguing, saying, no, it hasn't. Hey, got to run, got to break here, but thank you for the question. 866-34-TRUTH. We come back. I want to share some information with you that'll confirm that God's ways are ways of life, and that God's ways work best. And then maybe I'll get to some clips from Bill Maher. Last couple of times, I think I played clips from I Agreed with Him. Not this time. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to the line of fire, 866-34-TRUTH. So last week, I did a talk called God and Sex, Freedom and Anarchy at UNC, University of North Carolina, Greensboro. And the questions I put forth are biblical standards of sexual purity, destructive or constructive, helpful or harmful, binding or liberating. And I gave different principles to speak to someone that didn't even believe in God, as well as to believers. So first was the principle of reproduction, that everything reproduces after its own kind. So if you reproduce truth and multiply it endlessly, what do you end up with? Lots of truth, right? Multiply love. What do you end up with if you multiply love endlessly? Lots of love. How about hatred? Multiply hatred endlessly. What do you end up with? You end up with all types of violent acts and murder, and it keeps going, I mean, into massive degeneration. What about immorality? You multiply immorality, you reproduce immorality. What will that beget? What will that bring forth? Immorality multiplied endlessly will bring forth every kind of unimaginable perversion and action, because everything's going to reproduce after itself, the way God set things up in the book of Genesis, that trees had seed within themselves, animals had seed within themselves to reproduce themselves. So positive reproduction brings life. Negative reproduction brings death. How about the principle of trajectory? Principle of trajectory. You start in one place, you aim, and now you shoot. Let's say you're off a little bit. That little bit, 50 feet later, is a lot further. 100 feet, 1,000 feet, a lot further. A plane just gets a little bit off track and keeps on that trajectory. 1,000 miles into the flight, it's completely off track. So what's the trajectory of the natural organic family? What's the trajectory of that? Well, it's parents who produce and raise kids, who in turn produce and raise kids. That's the trajectory. Moms and dads having kids who then become moms and dads and have kids, and the generations keep perpetuating and one raising the next. What's the trajectory of the sexual revolution? As opposed to natural organic family as God intended it, what's the trajectory of the sexual revolution? It's an endless configuration of families with kids detached from their biological parents. That's where it ends up going. That's where it ends up going. It's the complete redefinition of marriage, as I just discussed with Professor Paul Kengor about an hour ago. The complete redefinition of marriage to all kinds of forms, because anything now goes. And even when you think it's LGBT movement, right? So that's part of the sexual revolution, part of the aftermath of the sexual revolution. Modern gay activism needs to be understood not as the successor to the civil rights movement, but the successor to the sexual revolution, just another offshoot of the sexual revolution of the 60s. So part of the trajectory of the sexual revolution is more than 50 ways to describe your gender. A gender becomes just whatever you perceive it is, with whatever number of forms and options you want. How about the principle of divine design? The principle of divine design. So first, I gave the principle of reproduction. What does this reproduce if you just let it keep going and going and going and going and going and going? Then the principle of trajectory. Which direction will this head? What will happen by implication? And then the principle of divine design. I'll share more on that when we come back in a moment on the line of fire. God's ways are ways of life. God's ways work. God's ways produce wonderful fruit from which you'll never have a regret. The ways of the flesh, quite the contrary.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Somebody explain this one to me, all right? Somebody explain this to me. Principle of Divine Design. Michael Brown, welcome back to The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. Phone lines are open. I'm curious to see if you have a theory, an answer to this, all right? So let's say you have man and woman. They grow up. They keep themselves sexually pure. They don't have sexual relations until they're married, all right? Then as a married couple, they have a healthy, active sex life as a married couple, and they're faithful to each other through the marriage, right? Will they get a sexually transmitted disease? I'm not talking about through a botched blood transfusion or something, but I'm talking about a sexually transmitted disease, transmitted sexually. Will they get a sexually transmitted disease? The answer is no. They won't. If they kept themselves sexually pure before marriage, then they get married, and they're faithful to each other in marriage. They have an active, healthy sex life. Will they get an STD? No. All right, now, we're talking about the principle of divine design. We do things according to God's pattern. It brings life. Let's say the exact same scenario, except that this couple, now that they're married, they fool around a little bit and sleep with people outside of wedlock. So they're doing the exact same things that they were doing with each other, now doing with others outside of wedlock. Will they get STDs? Are they doing enough times? Yeah, they will. They will. Where does it come from? Where do the STDs come from? And in other words, it's almost like this. Let's say, and again, I'm going to mix two different figures here, all right? But let's say it works like this. If you're married and you eat chocolate ice cream for dinner, but you're faithful to your spouse, not for dinner, for dessert, sorry. So you're married, you're faithful to your spouse, and you eat chocolate ice cream for dessert every night, that you won't gain weight, okay? Again, this is just to illustrate a point. However, if you commit adultery and eat that same ice cream, you will gain weight. In other words, why is it that the same acts performed by the same people, if performed only with each other in a faithful way before the Lord, you won't get an STD? But if you do the same thing with someone you're not married to, you could get an STD. Where do they come from? If it's not the act itself that produces it, then where do they come from? What's clear, though, is that if you follow God's pattern, you won't have this problem. Someone pointed out, and I presented this chart on PowerPoint at UNC Greensboro last week. When you have sex with someone, you're having sex with everyone they've had sex with, and with everyone they've had sex with, and on and on and on and on and on. It multiplies. Chlamydia, from 2002 to 2011, 216% increase in number of teen STD diagnoses, specifically with chlamydia. Let's go further. If you violate God's design even more, and it's an active sex life between males, this now goes off the charts with STDs. It is a massive illustration of the fact that God did not intend a man to be with a man. So if you look at number of new HIV infections from the Centers of Disease Control here in the States, the number of new infections that are due to white, black, and Hispanic men having sex with other men, overwhelmingly dominates the figures, even though they're less than 2% of the people. Violation of divine design. You can ask other questions in terms of God's plan, God's design. Where does cohabitation lead? Is it better or worse for long-term relations? We've had a massive increase in cohabitation and kids born out of wedlock. 1929, you're talking maybe 3-4% of kids were born out of wedlock. Today, over 40%. And if you just calculate based on mothers first-time mothers, so mothers having babies for the first time, it's half of all babies born are born out of wedlock. Well, what happens when you cohabit first? How does that work out? Because this is the argument. Before you buy the car, test drive it and see if you like it. Before you throw yourself into marriage, test drive it. Live together for a while. Share your resources together. Get to know each other better. See if you're emotionally and sexually compatible and all that. And then you see if marriage is going to work. You would think that that would produce longer lasting marriages according to the logic behind it. No, to the contrary. There's a much higher percentage of divorce for those who cohabit before they're married. And a much, much higher percentage of divorce for those who cohabit with others before they get married. So in other words, let's say a gal lives with a guy for 6 months, they break up, then she lives with someone else for 6 months, break up, then she meets her husband and they move in together, then they get married. They've got the highest percentage of all of probable divorce. Why? Because it's not the way God set things up. Same thing with fatherlessness, which has been greatly on the rise in America from 1960 until today. The stats on this are shocking as well, that the vast majority of kids under psychiatric care on medication, the vast majority of runaways, the vast majority of teen murderers, they come from fatherless homes. Why? God's ways are best. God's ways are best. And when we live by God's principles, there's blessing. There could be hardship, persecution, resistance, but there's blessing. When you cast them off, when you redefine marriage, when you redefine the meaning of family, when you get involved in all types of other sexual activities contrary to God's design, on and on the list goes. And as I sought to demonstrate to the students and others that were at the lecture at UNC Greensboro last week, this ultimately goes away of less stable marriages, less stable families, less stable society. You say, why address these issues? Why don't you just preach the gospel? Let me say this in response. Number one, this is part of the gospel. This is part of the gospel. Being salt, being light is part of the gospel. Caring about marriage, family is part of the gospel. Caring about societal well-being is part of the gospel. If it's part of the gospel to feed the poor, if it's part of the gospel to seek God's kingdom and his righteousness, then it's part of the gospel to care about marriage and family and the well-being of a society. So number one, it is part of the gospel. Number two, we also preach the gospel in terms of preaching Jesus as the only Savior. Just in the course of this week, gave clear calls to people who don't know the Lord and who don't have their sins forgiven to find forgiveness and grace through Jesus. But the other thing is this, there are plenty of other broadcasts on the very same radio stations you're listening to, and their calling is simply to teach through the Bible. Or their calling is simply to give evangelistic messages. Or their calling is simply to preach to strengthen the flock. In other words, there's plenty of preaching that's already on. There is plenty of teaching the word that's already on. We do that as well. But our calling on the line of fire is to be your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. And I say again, your voice to articulate things that are in your hearts, to give you the ability to articulate them yourselves, to be a voice to represent you where I can shout this message out across the airwaves around America and by internet around the world, that I can shout these truths out through new articles coming out almost every day that you can then share with others, so that we can equip you to be bold, to be courageous, to be world changers. I still remember a call from a woman, forget where exactly, may have been New Jersey. Her son's 13 years old, regular listeners to the broadcast. And through listening to the broadcast, she and her son received courage and became much more bold to witness for the gospel. You know, even when we simply know that God's ways work best, that God's principles are principles of life, even when we know and understand that, it emboldens us to speak. No, 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 we don't have to apologize for our faith. Look, if you're a salesperson, before I went to ministry, I was a commissioned salesperson years back, many years ago. So if I really had confidence in what I was selling, knew it was a good deal, and knew it was really going to help people, I would be a whole lot more effective than if I didn't believe in the product. Well, because we know God is good and his ways are good, and following him is the path to life, we are emboldened to speak and preach all the more. Hey, stand with us. Would you pray for us? Go to the website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. Click on donate. If you believe in what we're doing and want to help, it makes a big difference.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Now, ever since Indiana Governor Mike Pence signed his Religious Freedom Restoration Act, he and like-minded conservatives have been trying to have it both ways. They hate discrimination, but they love the Bible, a book that commands you to discriminate. That's what it says. Gay is an abomination, and we must destroy it by denying it pastry.
Yeah, here's the problem. Of course, that's the voice of Bill Maher in real time. The problem there is that what the Bible calls for is holiness and purity in life. And marriage as God intended it, and sexual relations as God intended it. So Bill Maher would also have to say that we discriminate against pornography. We discriminate against strip clubs. We discriminate against prostitutes. We discriminate against adultery. We discriminate against polygamy. In other words, if you're going to call it discrimination, at least be consistent. No, these are what are called moral values. Moral values. Bill Maher has his moral values, because of which he mocks and lambastes those who differ with him, people of faith, ridicules, mocks, and in ugly and even vulgar ways, and he's doing it in the name of anti-discrimination. That's the real shocker. That's the real hypocrisy, because Bill Maher would say he's against discrimination, but obviously in his attitude towards Christians and other people of faith is as discriminatory and biased as possibly could be. What we're simply saying is that we believe God's ways are best, and in good conscience, we can't participate in things that we regard as sinful. We'll treat everyone with love. Hey, when there's a catastrophe, when there's a natural disaster, who are the first responders around the world, as long as they're able to get to the place? Christians. And who are they feeding? Muslims. Who else are they feeding? Heterosexuals and homosexuals. Who else are they helping unpile the rubble from after an earthquake? Voodoo practitioners and people of different religious faiths and atheists. They're not asking. Well, hang on. Are you an atheist? No, we can't. No, we're not going to give you food. Wait. You're a Palestinian? No. We're not going to give you food. We only give it to the Israelis. Wait. You're a gay couple? No. We're not going to give you water. No. They're serving everyone sacrificially. Why? Because they love people. When they're asked to participate in something sinful, they say in good conscience, sorry, we can't do this. There is a letter to Christians in Indiana from Jesus, cleverly written, March 28th, 2015. And on the one hand, there's a lot that I like in the letter, supposedly from Jesus, obviously, you know, written in the first person from him, that he came to talk about his kingdom and things were supposed to be very different, supposed to be a pervasive, beautiful, relentless yeast in the dough that permeated the planet, an unstoppable virus of compassion and mercy spread person to person, not needing government or law or force. And that's how we do most of our work. That's how we do most of our work, of course. But when it came to the horrors of slavery, that work ultimately meant the government involvement. When it comes to combating human trafficking, to the extent we can have the government's help, we do it. Jesus purportedly says here, I've placed you here at this exact place and time in the history of creation, not to defend me, as I need no defense, not to protect me, since I've already willingly laid my life down, not to judge others on my behalf, as this is far beyond your capacity and my instruction. Okay, so just to be clear here, when this is allegedly Jesus speaking to his church, if we lived, I'm not comparing gays to Nazis. I'm not comparing gays to Nazis. I'm not comparing gays to Nazis. Got that? If we lived in the days of the Nazis and Dietrich Bonhoeffer, just remember the 70th anniversary of his death. Bonhoeffer said, "Silence in the face of evil is itself evil. God will not hold us guiltless. Not to speak is to speak. Not to act is to act." So, if you lived as a Christian in Nazi Germany, you don't want to judge the Nazis, right? You don't want to judge the human traffickers today. That's not what "don't judge" means. The letter continues, all that is happening these days, all the posturing and the debating and the complaining, does this really look like love to you? Do you really think that the grandstanding and the insult slinging and the side choosing, that it feels like me? Well, from what I can tell, this person claiming to speak for Jesus wants to take real sides on these issues, but disagrees with the sides that many Christians take. Are there Christians who act in an acrimonious way? Absolutely, and it's shameful. Are there Christians who act in an unchristlike way? Absolutely, and it's shameful. Do they write and post and act and speak in a fleshly anger? Absolutely, and it's shameful. And I grieve over that and ask the world to forgive us for those that do act like that. But in point of fact, Christians are loving people day and night, loving their neighbors as themselves day and night, showing the goodness of Jesus day and night, and with love saying, sorry, I can't participate in something that's sinful. So to this person who writes this letter, supposedly from Jesus, can I ask a question? What would you like us to do? Let's say you're a Christian photographer and someone comes in and says, listen, we're having a Satanist festival and we want like the... we want you to shoot this for us. It's going to be a lot of blood and gore and like mock sadomasochist stuff and all this and you know, praise to Satan. And we hear you're a really good, sensitive photographer. So we'd like you to shoot that. So Jesus would say, don't judge. Just go ahead and shoot that and serve. You think so? How about this? We just started a new porn magazine and we hear you're the best photographer in the city here. And we want you to do a shoot for us, real sensitive, nice shoot. And you know, we're going to use that for a new magazine. You're supposed to say as a Christian, oh, yeah, sure, I'll do it. No, the word is explicit. The word is explicit. Have nothing to do with the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but rather expose them. In fact, light brings darkness into view and thereby rebukes it and reproves it. And we're called to be the light of the world. So we do it with love. We serve sacrificially. We walk in grace. However, we refuse to compromise our convictions, and we remember how bold and strong and uncompromising Jesus himself was, both with the religious and the worldly, that he called to repent and follow him and take up the cross and do his will. All right, friends, it is wake-up time for the nation. The Mystery of the Shemitah, I was watching it, I don't know, 3:30 in the morning last night, the DVD, compelling narrative, almost shockingly compelling, by Jonathan Cahn. Great graphics production. It's 2 hours. You get an hour of bonus material on it. When you get the DVD, we're also including free my interview with Jonathan earlier today, a compelling interview as well on CD. So both resources, just $20, postage paid. To order, call 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978. My bottom line today, God's ways are ways of life. The ways of the flesh bring death. Don't apologize for God's ways. Live them out.